with us for this second oral argument today. Various students. We have with us students from Xavier High School. Would they please stand? Good. Thank you very much for coming. You may be seated. We also have students from the University of Wisconsin Law School. Would they please stand? What class do you represent?
2013.
Pardon me?
2013.
That isn't right.
That is a direct response to a question that is not sufficiently detailed. So I'll rephrase my question. Counsel, are you all enrolled in the same substantive class for which you are attending this oral argument? The answer is yes.
So raise your right hand if you will.
If so, what class? Pardon me? Okay, good. That was not the answer I expected, but I'm delighted you're all here, as is the court. You may be seated. The law students are here because they're probably getting credit and are required to attend. But the Xavier High School students are here with a program called Court with Class. This is a program that is sponsored by the State Bar and by this court. We invite high school students from around the state to participate in the educational program about the school system and about the courts, and they are invited to come to an oral argument. If they accept the invitation, they give a material about the case and come to an oral argument. And part of the program is that a justice will be assigned that day to speak with the students after this second oral argument about the procedures of the court, not the substantive issues of the particular case. And this Court with Class program is part of a broader program of outreach that this court sponsors. And we are moving into a new aspect of that program with a program sponsored by Sandra Day O'Connor. Called, what is it, iCivics now, and that will be spearheaded by Justice Bradley. And you might call your school's attention to this program, and it is linked on our website. With those introductory remarks made, I will now introduce the court to you all. Starting on my far left is Justice Michael Gableman. Seated next to him is Justice Patience Robensack. She is the justice with whom you will meet this afternoon. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice, and to my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. And to Justice Bradley's right, Justice, there you are, David Prosser. And to his right, Justice Annette Ziegler. With those introductions made, I'll now call the second case, which is also a criminal case, 08AP1968CR, State versus Patrick R. Patterson. Arguing on behalf of Mr. Patterson is David Karp. Then we will hear from the Assistant Attorney General, Michael Sanders, and Mr. Karp, you'll have 5 minutes in rebuttal. You may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is David Karp. I represent the petitioner, Patrick Patterson. The first issue in the case involves the appropriateness of cumulative punishments and whether it violates due process to impose cumulative punishments for the offenses of first-degree reckless homicide and contributing to the delinquency of a child resulting in death based on the same act. There's a statute that controls. I wish for the educational purposes I could project this to the audience, but I'm looking at 939.66(2). And read in relevant part, it's called conviction of included crime permitted. It says, upon prosecution for a crime, the actor may be convicted of either the crime charged or an included crime, but not both. So I realize that it's going to be at issue in this case as to whether or not the plain meaning of the statute controls, and my first position is that it does, but I'll be addressing a backup position as well. But clearly the statute says that the actor may be convicted of the crime charged or an included crime, but not both. It says, but not both. Then it goes on to say an included crime may be any of the following. And I'm going to go right to subsection 2, which says, a crime which is a less serious type of criminal homicide than the one charged. And it is Mr. Patterson's position that that contributing to the delinquency of a child resulting in death is a less serious form of criminal homicide than first-degree reckless homicide. So as a threshold question, of course, we have to decide, well, are these both types of criminal homicide? And probably the bigger question is, well, is contributing to the delinquency of a child a type of criminal homicide? And indeed, it is. The drafters of the latest revision to the additions in Chapter 948 saw it as a specialized form of homicide. And in fact, the drafters actually foresaw the sort of problem that would issue here in terms of how to instruct the jury and lesser included offenses. Now, there's a case, of course, lurking on the sides here, which doesn't involve this specific subsection, but involves subsection 2M, which relates to battery, and that's, of course, Davison. I note that this court did not find that the plain meaning controlled in Davison, but I would submit that Davison is distinguishable for a couple of different reasons. First of all, obviously, Davison involved battery. I would note that 2M is a relatively recent newcomer to the statute that 939.66 originally included sub 2. But it did not include 2M. Further, the reason that the court went beyond the plain meaning in Davison is that there appears to be some sort of problem here. The statute talks about a crime which is a less serious or equally serious type of battery than the one charged. So there's a special problem there of battery because it talks about a lesser included, yet one that is the same potential class. Plus, I would note it doesn't even say criminal battery, whereas sub 2 just say criminal homicide. So under the plain meaning, a person should not be convicted of a lesser form of criminal homicide. Now, if we go beyond plain meaning and look at the intent of the drafters, it's true that this section is under subchapter 5, which talks about rights of the prosecution. However, there was clearly a balancing act going on with regard to this language in order to permit the prosecution two bites of the apple, if you will, that is, to submit a lesser form of homicide in case the jury would not be convinced beyond a reasonable doubt of the greater.
Isn't there a question, Counselor, about whether contributing to the delinquency of a child is a lesser form of homicide, just interpreting the statute?
There's no doubt that it's lesser under Lechner, or Lechner, because it's the maximum punishment level is lower. However, there is the question is, well, does it? It would really go to the part of the test that looks at the nature of the offense. Do first degree reckless homicide and contributing to the delinquency of a child both or resulting in death? Do they both protect life? I would submit that they do.
Well, if you look at the elements under Blockberger, though, don't they have separate and distinct elements that would have to be proved in order to be convicted of those two different offenses?
I totally agree. This isn't a Blockberger case. I'm not arguing double jeopardy. It doesn't apply under sub 1, which codifies Blockberger. And that's why we're talking about a due process violation here rather than double jeopardy. I would submit that the drafters saw the contributing to the delinquency of a child resulting in death statute as a specialized form.
A specialized form of contributing to the delinquency, or a specialized form of homicide? I hear you arguing to me it's a specialized form of homicide, and I guess my question goes more to whether the statute itself is a less serious form of homicide, or whether contributing to the delinquency of a child is a very separate and distinct crime that could have serious impairment to the child, no lasting effect to the child, or death of the child. And so as I look at the statute that you point out to us, you know, I try to interpret, well, what did the legislature mean? Why did they include that in the statute? So that's kind of where my question was going.
Justice Rogensack, I agree, and that's why in my reply brief I included a copy of the letter from the reporter, the executive secretary of the Judicial Council, discussing the statute. That is late Mr. Fullen, who wasn't really crazy about this statute, nor was he of the felony murder statute. Nonetheless, there's surely no question that felony murder is a homicide statute, nor should there be any question that contributing to the delinquency of a child resulting in death is a homicide statute. It requires an act which causes death.
Okay.
I would submit that if a statute prohibits an act that causes a human death, that would make it a homicide statute. I mean, the state doesn't agree with me. The state barely agrees with me that it's even a statute, but that that seems to be the case. However, I think the language of the statute is the language of the contributing to the delinquency of a child resulting in death statute shows that it is in fact a form of, or a type of criminal homicide, purely criminal.
Counsel, along those lines, and while we're talking about the language of the contributing to the delinquency of a child with death as a result, what is your response, I wonder, to the state's argument raised in its brief that there is no requirement based on the plain language of that statute that the death actually occur to the child?
Justice Gableman, I agree that that's certainly a problem. There may be a case where there's a second death, but then you're not talking about the problem we have here. Here we have one act and one death, so that would clearly be a distinguishable situation.
But doesn't your argument hang, though? Doesn't your argument rely to some extent on its cumulative nature of the punishment wouldn't quite be so cumulative if they were different laws, totally separate from each other, not lesser included?
If you have, Justice Gableman, I'm going to try to answer the question this way, and it's not an easy question, I admit. But suppose you have two deaths, and one is charged as an intentional homicide, and one is a reckless. There, you've got two deaths there, so it's a different sort of situation. You can't argue that where there's two deaths, that a person can't be convicted of both.
I think Justice Gableman is really going at a different point than that. What I hear him saying is that the statute contributing to the delinquency of a child with death as a result does not have to be the death of the child who was led into delinquency. That child could be part of a circumstance where nothing happened to the child who was led into, but the child somehow participated in a series of events where a third party was killed. I think that's more what he's looking at.
Justice Rogenczyk, I agree. I agree. In fact, that happened in the Schulter case, which I cited to. But again, in this case, that issue isn't raised because it is, in fact, the putative. I'm going to say putative child because I disagree with the definition of child as interpreted by the lower courts, but nonetheless, that the deceased was in fact the person who was allegedly rendered delinquent by.
So your response to the state's argument in that regard, which I asked about, and which Justice Rogenczyk fleshed out, would be that it's fact dependent. It's dependent on the facts, and since the facts here are that the subject of the delinquency, whether or not a child, I understand that you dispute that for the purposes of this statute, because that was the case, that there was but one death, that therefore, because of those facts, the statutes are, punishment would be cumulative because of those facts. If it was a different set of facts, then no cumulative punishment. That's where I thought you were going.
Justice Gableman, I realize that we're talking about a question of law rather than a factual question. If there's only one death, then the problem arises. If there's two deaths, the problem doesn't arise. I sort of see that as being a totally different arena. It's in a felony murder situation, you've got something similar. And yet, I don't think anybody would say that felony murder would not be a lesser included offense under sub 2. Felony murder, it doesn't have to be the, for example, the death of someone who the actor intended to die, and that's the sort of the doctrinal problem that Mr. Fullen saw, in fact, with retaining the statute of causing death by contributing to the delinquency of a child. There's
If I could, while you're being interrupted, I'm looking at 939.66. And we can, I think the law is clear, at least I think, that the state can prosecute for any number of crimes, whether they are lesser included, more or less serious, can prosecute and charge them all. But ultimately, whether there's more than one conviction will depend on 939.65 and 66, and there may be other statutes that will govern that. So far, okay?
Yes.
And what the statute does, 939.66, it has 12 or 13 subdivisions. And they say, they define what an included crime is. Because the rule is you may be convicted of either the crime charged or an included crime, and the state has its own reading of that, but for the moment, so you fit into one of them. So one is the usual definition of an included offense having one less element. Two is very different. It doesn't have to be an included offense, right? Just has to be a less serious type of criminal homicide, right?
I agree that it doesn't have to be a block burger
right.
included offense.
Right.
But nonetheless, by statute, it is an included offense.
Yes, we're saying the same thing. By statute, the legislature has said all homicides that are less serious are included in a more serious homicide, whether it has totally different elements or not. Right? Okay. That's that's the point I'm trying to make, and I agree with you. And 2M is the battery one, which doesn't say less serious. It says less serious or equally serious. Okay. How have the cases defined less serious?
My understanding is Lechner says clearly that if the maximum penalty is less than the other one, that makes it a lesser offense.
Okay. So let's start out with, is the delinquency charge less serious than the reckless homicide? That is the delinquency charge have a lower penalty? Now, the delinquency has two penalties. One, if there's no death, and two, if there is death, right?
Yes.
And if there's death, that's a felony D. Is that less serious than reckless homicide, first-degree reckless? Okay. All right. So we get it into less serious. Now we have the problem of is delinquency, contributing to delinquency, when there's a death of the delinquent, which is the facts here, is that a criminal homicide? Right?
Yes.
That's the issue in this case. Right? Why wouldn't it be criminal homicide? You got a death. So, what's the strongest argument against your position?
The strongest argument against my position?
Because I want you to answer it. Because on the face of it, it looks like, hey, you got delinquency, death, right? You got two crimes in there.
All right, well, Chief Justice, I think the answer to that is why I lost in the Court of Appeals.
Okay, tell us why you lost in the Court of Appeals.
Because of Davison.
Okay, what about Davison?
Well, I presented there that the Court of Appeals looked at the standard four-part test, the language, the history, the nature of the statute, the appropriateness of cumulative punishment, and they focused on the first two. And said, well, that's Patterson's strongest argument, but Davison says no. that the Court of Appeals found that I did not present a good reason to distinguish Davison. And I see that as a problem, but not an insurmountable problem. As I said, first of all, we're clearly talking about battery. Battery is not a homicide. Everyone knows that. More specifically, it's clear that the history of 2M is a lot different than sub 2.
The history of 2M? 2M says that an included crime is a crime which is less serious or equally serious type of battery. What were the batteries in Davidson?
The batteries in Davison were, if I recall correctly, there was one under 940.19 and nine under 940.20. And that's part of the problem with Davison, the specifics of how the crime of battery is codified. You've got a sort of unitary statute, 940.19, which contains several degrees of battery, and then in addition to that, you've got other statutes following 940.19, 940.20, and so on, that address special circumstances of battery. And so in Davison, the problem the defense had was that, well, the legislature has indicated a need for cumulative punishment here by having these statutes out of the way, and also by permitting even equally serious degrees of battery to be submitted to the jury, so that you can go outside the main battery statute 940.19 and actually obtain other convictions outside that. I would submit that is a problem specific to the battery statute and to 2M, and that battery simply is addressed differently than homicide has been.
If it's addressed the same, if there's no meaningful distinction, then you lose under Davidson?
If there's no distinction, Justice Bradley, if there has to be a distinction. And again, the history of the statutes is different.
Well, your opposing counsel will say there's no meaningful distinction, right? I mean, your opposing counsel relies heavily on the Davison case.
Yes. But again, it seems to me that Davison could be isolated to its facts, the way that the rationale in Davison is worked out. So Davison should be isolated to its facts, but even if it's not, it should relate to battery and the specific problems of battery. We don't have a statute called simply homicide that has varying degrees of homicide contained under it, as you do in the battery statute.
Thank you. Counsel, the chief asked you what's the best argument against you, and then make it well. What about the legislative history? It's your position that the legislative history makes this a homicide offense. A contrary position is that this is not a homicide offense at all. It's a contributing to the delinquency of a minor offense. What legislative history is for or against your position?
I've definitely found history for me In the Fullen letter specifically that I attached to the reply brief, it's seen as a specialized form of criminal homicide. The counter argument is, it's a misdemeanor that's aggravated because it caused a death. But you can't get around the fact that there's causation of death, and that makes it a criminal homicide. I did want to address the other issues, but I see I'm out of time here. So I might have to stand.
You are, and you'll have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you.
And the court is aware of the other issues, and I assume you're not, you're still relying on them and rely on your brief.
If I may.
Thank you, counsel. Michael Sanders, Assistant Attorney General, State of Wisconsin.
May it please the court, my name is Michael Sanders, and I represent the state of Wisconsin in this case. The state asked this court to affirm the decision of the circuit court and the unanimous decision of the Court of Appeals, which denied each of the four claims raised. This court has spent most of its time on the first issue, the multiplicity claim, and I would like to start there. I think this is a plain language case under 93966. But what the plain language of 93966 shows, I think, is that it does not apply in this case at all. As the court made, I think, clear in the Davison case, when you read the entire statute and think about the context of the statute, it shows up in a subchapter titled Rights of the Prosecution, and it starts by saying upon prosecution for a crime. It's not dealing with this type of an instance where the state has charged more than one crime up front. It deals really only with what didn't happen here, which is where one crime is charged, and then at trial, either the prosecutor or the defense asks that there be more included crimes that the jury can consider. That isn't what happened here, and I don't think the statute applies whatsoever.
Just fill me in. If there's a charge of one crime and then the evidence shows a totally different crime, can you then amend the pleadings? Or are you limited to by the legal definition of lesser included?
I think that in this case, under this statute, the only way that the state can get a lesser included is under this exact statute, and that the only ones which it can get are what it says here, which is in sub 1, which is the block. Blockburger test, and then all of the other ones which have been set forth. As it says in the jury instructions for this SM6, in order to instruct the jury on a lesser included offense, the offense must qualify under one of the subsections of 93966. A trial court is not permitted to instruct or submit a verdict on a lesser crime which is not included in the charged crime. And the point of 93966 is to give the option of having included crimes, and then it sets forth what those are.
Counsel, let's say there's a first degree intentional homicide, and then there's a second degree reckless. Normally, I would think of second-degree reckless as being a lesser-included offense.
Mm-hmm.
You agree with that?
Yes.
Okay. Your interpretation of 93966 seems to be this. If they charge the first degree but don't charge the second degree,
mm-hmm.
And submit that second degree to the jury, however,
mm-hmm.
then there is a prohibition on being convicted of both.
Yes.
If, however, they charge the first degree and charge the second degree reckless,
mm-hmm.
and both are submitted to the jury, there is no prohibition on being convicted of both. Is that your position?
Yes. Under 93966, I don't think there is one.
When I read that, I wrote a note on the side and I said, prosecutorial hocus pocus. And by that I mean, you know, if you want to deprive a constitutional right here, then it's just a matter of how you plead. Plead them both. In other words, charge both. Because if you only charge one and then submit the lesser included at the time when it goes to the jury, which is a very common practice, then you can't be convicted of both. Why wouldn't the prosecutor just always charge both? Or charge four or five? You know, when you think of all the lesser included, you could do first degree intentional, first degree reckless, you could do then second degree reckless, and you could do maybe negligent handling of a weapon. I mean, all of them, you can charge all of those. And then you could be convicted of all of those under your theory because they're all charged.
Well, I think that's what it says under 93965.
Is that the way Davison interprets that statute?
I think so.
What language are you relying on?
Well, when it says that, that it's in, just one second, please.
So, counsel, you're really saying that a prosecutor can charge and convict someone of multiplicitous crimes so long as they do it?
I'm only saying that I don't think it's barred under 93966.
Right. You'd still have to apply Blockberger to determine whether or not you can get convicted of lesser included when the elements, when you don't have to prove any different element in a crime. So what you're saying is that 93966 is an analysis of what happens if you charge a particular crime
mm-hmm.
and then later on want to submit something else to the jury.
Yeah, I think
that's where this statute applies, but it doesn't read Blockberger out of the lexicon of what we have to do.
And I think that this court has known that that's what the statute means. In some older cases, going back to 1998, in the Vassos case, this court said, the reason behind the rule of this section is the state's difficulty in determining before a trial exactly what crime or degree of the crime it will be able, upon the trial, to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. That's really what it's there for.
Counsel, please continue.
I will want to check my brief to find what I want to find, so if you could ask your question, that would be great.
Okay. Let me be clear. When we look at the statute 93966, I mean, of course, your Blockberger is still good law. You're relying on Blockberger. There, 93965 and 66 talk about when you can get two convictions. And under 93966, sub 1, that's a codification of Blockberger.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an elements-only test. And a crime which does not require proof of another fact in addition to those which must be proved for the crime is statutorily a lesser-included
mm-hmm.
situation. But the legislature says, okay, but we have some other statutory lesser-included offenses, right?
Mm-hmm.
And one is sub 2, mm-hmm. and that deals with a less serious type of homicide. And one is 2M, which deals with battery. And so even though there is an elements-only test in Blackburger, the legislature has mandated statutorily lesser-included offenses, even though they may not meet the elements test of Blackburger.
Yes.
Okay. Let me get back to the question I asked earlier regarding, you said that your interpretation was mandated by Davison.
Yes.
That is the interpretation that if they charge both first and second, they can be convicted of both, but if they charge only first and submit first and reckless or second to the jury, they can only can be convicted of one. You said that interpretation of the statute is mandated by Davison. Where in Davison do you get that
I don't
mandate?
Think it's mandated by that case, but I think that's what the court strongly implies is the way that the statute should be read. It starts in approximately paragraph 65 and goes from there for between 65 and 67.
And maybe even 77. That was one of the paragraphs you referred to. The clear implication of the comment is the defendant may be charged with one crime, but ultimately convicted of an included crime, a lesser included, that is not charged.
Yes.
That's italicized. And you've referenced that specific language in
the
brief.
And paragraph 67 also, where it talks about because both battery statutes were charged.
Yes. And in that case, they were charged. In this case, they were both charged. I just don't think that the statute applies. I think that if you consider what the statute's really getting at, it kind of explains the 2 and 2M, where one deals with a less serious and the other deals with a less or equally serious. What I think that means is that the legislature has defined and included homicide as any type which is less serious. So under the opening part of it, where it says the actor may be convicted of either the crime charged or an included crime, but not both, you couldn't be convicted under the statute of two equally serious, or a charged crime and a more serious, because those wouldn't fall under sub 2. Because an included crime is only a crime which is less serious. So you can't have both if it's more or if it's equal, because it wouldn't fall under sub 2. And you can't have one if it's less serious, because that is an included crime, and it says you can't have both.
So
you really can't have two. If one's charged and the other one isn't, you can't ever have two.
That's right. That's the way you interpret it. Are we dealing here, what constitutional right are we dealing with in this discussion?
His due process right not to be charged twice for the same offense.
Is double jeopardy implicated?
In the Lechner case, it talked about that at length, how it's really not a double jeopardy claim. It's really more of a multiplicity claim, because he's not being charged or tried twice.
So the constitutional due process right really boils down to whether or not you charge both first and second for the same underlying conduct, and then no violation of due process if both are charged and you're convicted of both. But if you charge one and submit that one that's charged and a lesser included, then there is a due process violation. Seems pretty...
I think it's a statutory violation.
Well, a statutory due process violation?
I think it just comes back to what he relies only on 93966 to show a clear intent not to allow this.
But this, we are talking about due process, right?
Okay.
I mean, I'm asking. Maybe sure. You're saying there's no due process implicated here, no constitutional right implicated.
Well, in this case, no. If for no other reason than that, as I argued in the brief at some length, the two crimes, one is a type of homicide and one isn't. It's really not the same thing.
I thought the whole due process argument or double jeopardy argument deals with, hey, if the legislature wanted to punish twice, they could do it. Is that right? I mean, when you cut everything out, is that the ultimate?
Seems like it sometimes comes down to that. And in this case, I think under 93965, that's exactly what it says.
So the ultimate...
And that 93966 just doesn't really apply.
Well, the ultimate test is, what did the legislature intend?
Okay.
And the whole Blockburger is, if the elements are the same, the facts are the same, you can... assumption or presumption is the legislature did not intend double punishment, right?
Okay.
But if the facts are not the same or the elements are not the same, presumption is legislature did intend double punishment, right?
Okay.
Okay. So what we're looking for is legislative intent, mm-hmm. right? And doesn't 939.66 tell us what the legislature intended? I mean, that's how I read these statutes.
I think it does, but I don't think it applies. I think it says upon prosecution for a crime, the actor may be convicted of either the crime charged or an included crime, but not both. And then it explains what an included crime is for the purposes of that where you've been charged with only the one crime, not where you were first charged with both.
Now, in Davidson and paragraph 68, there's a discussion of whether it's you're dealing with charged and uncharged crimes. It also is in 65. Does Davidson ever help us on whether your interpretation is correct or incorrect?
Well, I think it ends up, it says that there are two different ways you could read this. One is the way that I would like it to be read. The other is the opposite way. And at the end, it says, well, not the right way to read it is the way that I want, but that way at least seems to make more sense. And the way the case comes out, I think, shows that that's what the court got to. That's where the court got to.
So the state is, as Justice Bradley said, advised, if we take your position, DAs are advised to charge everything.
I would say that under 93966, it doesn't say that they can't. Under 93965, it says that they can.
93965, 93966, and all the cases seem to say the DA can charge everything. The only issue comes up at the end mm-hmm. in sentencing, conviction and sentencing,
sure.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So the state's position would encourage the state to charge everything.
I think all I can say is that 93966 doesn't say that the state can't.
Let me give you a hypothetical. That is, let's say a defendant shot and killed one victim in a bar fight. That's the underlying conduct. So the state could charge with that underlying conduct one count of first degree intentional, one count, you know, if you moved the gun around a bit, one count of first degree reckless, one count of second degree reckless, one count of homicide by maybe negligent use of a weapon, maybe one count of homicide by intoxicated use of a weapon, and get convictions on all of them and sentence on each one separately, all for the one defendant who who shot the one victim. That's what your argument really would lead me to.
Well, there isn't any prohibition against two counts of against two convictions of homicide for causing one death, as the court has found in Lechner and Wolski. That can work.
As long as it doesn't violate 93966, you can do it.
Yeah.
As long as it doesn't violate the Blockberger elements test or 2 or sub 2 here.
Is
the lesser type of criminal homicide. And what I gave you in that laundry list were all a less serious type of criminal homicide, right? I mean, I went down the gradation.
Sure.
So all of them can be charged, and they could all be convicted.
I think there's nothing in 93966 which says that isn't the case.
Counsel, help me think of a time when I'm trying to figure out what. It seems like it should be obvious, but it isn't necessarily obvious to me. What criminal homicide means in 93966. Less serious type seems to be the penalty. Is there a lesser penalty? Criminal homicide has to be the crime. Criminal homicide. So is contributing to the delinquency of a child criminal homicide? Certainly has different elements than first degree reckless homicide or first degree intentional homicide. First degree intentional and first degree reckless would both be criminal homicides, don't you
sure.
think?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So help me think through, and so if both of those, if one were a lesser included of another, then one, do you think 93966 would preclude you from having convictions on both?
If they were both charged, or if one both. Was charged and one was submitted as a lesser?
Well, give me each analysis under your viewpoint.
If they're both charged, I don't think that it would come into play. If one is charged and one isn't, then you could not have convictions on both.
Okay, and that's because of 93966 in your view?
Yes.
Okay. So I'm not necessarily agreeing with you, but assuming that to be the case, that's an example of criminal homicide being the crime.
Sure.
So now I'm trying to figure out when, if ever, is contributing to the delinquency of a child a criminal homicide as a crime. Is it because death was the consequence? Is that the one thing that makes that now transform to a criminal homicide?
Well, I don't think it does turn into a homicide statute. I think it's meant to deal with contributing to the delinquency of a child. It's meant to deal with causing a child to violate a law. And that's really it. You can get more time, and it's viewed as a more
serious
crime if there is a death as a consequence. But as I wrote in the brief, there isn't anything saying that it has to be the death of the child. It doesn't really matter. It could be any death. And it's not that the defendant caused that death. He didn't kill the person under most cases. It's that he did something which caused the child to break a law, and then someone died, whether it's the child or any other person.
What does a Blockberger have to do with the statute 93966?
Sub 1 is the codification of the Blockberger test. I think the court has said that in Lechner and Sauceda and a few other cases.
Mr. Sanders, yes. I'd like you to address for a minute the argument of opposing counsel in regard to legislative history concerning 93166-2, and specifically the argument he makes that this is a homicide statute based on the letter from Mr. Fullen when he was executive director of the Judicial Council. How do you respond to that?
I don't think that that helps that his case. I think it shows that at the time there was a thought that you could have two charges for exactly what happened here and a reckless homicide, say. And he thought that that wasn't a good thing. It's clear from what he wrote. And he urged that this statute be repealed because I think he didn't like the idea that you could have two convictions. And yet it wasn't repealed. And it's exactly what we have on the books now. And I think he did see that what he would think of as not the best result could happen, and that's exactly what the statute says.
Doesn't it support the argument, though, that this indeed is a homicide statute?
He does use the term, but I don't. That's all I could find any place that said anything about it. And I guess I don't really know that I would agree.
You have a very interesting argument based on the plain text of this statute, right? Well, 990.001 says the singular includes the plural, right?
Okay.
So if we read this in the plural, does it change anything? Upon prosecution for crimes, the actor may be convicted of either the crime charged or an included crime, but not both. So you can have a charged crime to be an included crime.
Have a charged crime to be.
By definition.
Battery, substantial battery.
Sure. You can have, if you have two types of homicide that you and I agree are in, that the one with the lesser punishment is included, the prosecutor charges both. So now I'm reading upon prosecution for crimes, which is both the crime and the lesser included. The actor may be convicted of either the crime charged or an included crime. And one of those crimes charged is an included crime by definition. So I find your reading of that, when I look at the singular includes the plural, faulty. What do you think of that?
Interesting. I guess I haven't seen anything.
I'm sure you'd agree with me totally, right?
Not necessarily.
Not today. Okay, go ahead.
Sometimes. I guess that is a new way to read it that I hadn't thought of, and I don't believe the defendant has addressed, or that the court addressed in the Davison case or the Court of Appeals addressed in this case.
The Davison case addressed a lot of issues. The Davison case addressed Blockberger, mm-hmm. right, even though it's not under sub 1.
Even though the
Davison case didn't fall under
someone, right, sure.
It addressed Blockberger. It addressed the whole concept of, if I'm right, it cited Missouri v. Hunter or comparable cases on legislative intent, right? Mm-hmm. And then it looked at 2M, and then it looked through under 2M. I think that you'd say on the plain reading of 2M, you had two batteries. Mm-hmm. And then it said, yeah, but it doesn't mean that. And it looked at a lot of legislative history and wound up saying legislature didn't intend this, right? I mean, ultimately, it was a legislative intent case.
It was, but that just confirmed what I think the court thought was a plain language view of the statute.
Which is your view of the statute.
It's the view that I am now taking. Yes, it's not the view that I took then because that I wasn't involved. But yes, and I think that it said that if you read all of the words of the statute, think about the context, and then look at all of the history, that that's what it means. And that the more logical way to read it is that it deals with only where one crime is charged and the other isn't, rather than where both are charged.
Is Lechner still good law, or did Davison sub silentio overrule Lechner?
Lechner should be clarified, I think, under Davison. What they were dealing with there was two different counts of homicide for causing one death. And the court found that there was nothing in the statute which says that you can't do that, that you can't have both. And I think that that's right. It really relied upon the fact that the statute says a less serious type. And it said, well, in that case, they were both equally serious, so we don't have a problem. And to an extent, that's right. It didn't say anything wrong. It just didn't get to the actual, to what the statute actually meant.
Is there anything, some would advance that Lechner and Davison are inconsistent?
I think the implication in Lechner is that 93966 applies to both where one crime is charged and another is an included charge, which is given to the jury. And it also applies when both crimes are charged. And in Davison, I think it at least strongly indicates that that isn't the case, that really the 93966 only applies when one crime is charged and another is given to the jury, but not in the first instance.
Not when both are charged. There's
yes.
No protection from double conviction if both are charged.
Yes, and I think that actually that view helps explain why the statute says equally serious, and I tried to touch on this earlier, and I don't think I did well. If I could go on for just a moment, is that?
You have a few seconds.
Thank you. And I think it's because it didn't have to deal in sub 2 with it where it says an included crime is a less serious type of homicide than the one charged. It doesn't say more or equally because those aren't included crimes under the statute. I don't believe I said that correctly. But it basically said to be a lesser in included, we're going to define that as a less serious type. So the only way you could have two convictions under this, if one is charged, and the only way you could ever possibly have two is if one is charged and the other is less serious, and then it says, and we aren't going to let you do that. It didn't have to say equally serious or more serious because it defined an included crime as one which is less serious. So really, if only one count is charged, there's no way you could ever have two. Whether it's more serious, less serious, equally serious, it doesn't really matter. You could only have one. And that, I think, explains why sub 2 uses that term, whereas under 2M, when the lawmakers passed that statute, they specifically defined and included battery as one that's equally serious or less serious. There are just other types of batteries which could come into play, but they just chose to define it differently. Thank you.
Mr. Sanders.
There are certainly good policy reasons for permitting a multiple charging scheme, as the justices have discussed here today. It sort of puts the defendant on notice that he might be looking at lesser included. Plus, it's an opportunity for plea bargaining, the prosecution to agree to dismiss a greater count in return for a plea on the lesser. However, the charging decision can't be the final word in terms of cumulative punishments. That is up to the legislature. Now, if the court had accepted that sub 2M was unambiguous, I submit the result in Davison would have been different. The problem there was that my understanding is that the court found that 2M was ambiguous, and 2M certainly has problems, and certainly you have to look at the legislative history if there's ambiguity. I don't think 2 is is ambiguous to that extent. Even so, under 2M, even if you're looking at it literally, you can see, you can infer intent, certainly, for an offense in the basic battery statute, 940.19, and one outside, for example, because sub 2M says of equal degree, that might certainly imply that the legislator intended that a class H felony under 940.19 and one under special circumstances, class H under 940.20, those were both permissible. However, you don't have that sort of situation here. And it is, we do in fact have 939.66 under rights of prosecution, but I would submit that under the rights of prosecution, there's included rights of defendants that the drafters intended that to be a balancing act. That I've referred to references made by Attorney General Platts in that regard, and you can see even where we have rights of the defendant, and I'm looking specifically at 939.71, talking about limitation on the number of prosecutions, that too seems to go to Blockburger, but also that includes rights of the prosecution. So even though it's in the section under rights of defendants, it also includes rights of the prosecution. So there's a sort of yin-yang thing going on here. I don't think we can conclude that 939.66 was only intended to protect the rights of the prosecution. The history is very contrary. It's clear we're not under Blockburger here. And I realize that because we're not under Blockburger, it means I have the burden of showing that the legislature did not intend that cumulative punishments are appropriate. I would submit I have met that burden. If it was Blockburger, the presumption would be going the other way.
Counsel, help me out on whether criminal homicide and death are always the same thing. Because in the contributing to the delinquency of a child, death is a consequence. But is that death always a homicide? Or could that death not be a homicide? And because the 939.66 talks about criminal homicide. Or are there times when that would be multiplicitous and times when it wouldn't be multiplicitous?
Justice Ziegler, I can certainly think of fact situations where it wouldn't be multiplicitous, but in this situation it would be a criminal homicide. Nonetheless, there's the whole concept of proximate cause, and that's what the Schulter's case says. So you can't prosecute someone for contributing to delinquency of a child causing death if you say, give the child a gun, and the child then sells the gun to another party, who then sells it to someone else, et cetera, and then halfway around the world, someone gets shot. So there is a cutoff for that, and that is I believe Schulter does in fact support the position that it is a homicide statute. You have an act. It causes death. Death as a consequence is tantamount to saying that the act causes the death. So yes, it is a criminal homicide statute. It's not simply a statute where you have an aggravated penalty because somewhere in the world there was a death.
Thank you, Mr. Carr. I'm sorry, Justice Prosser.
Can I give you a hypothetical here? If I want somebody killed. I want someone murdered. And I hire somebody to do that. What is that? Is that a 940.01? And the death occurs. Is that a 940.01 party to the crime?
So if you solicit...
Beg your pardon?
You're saying... Justice Prosser, if you solicit someone to commit a first-degree intentional homicide. I suppose there'd be liability, certainly in terms of aiding and abetting and conspiring. I don't know that it would. I'm sorry. Am I on the right
track? There's going to be some statute that I can be charged for soliciting and arranging for a first-degree intentional homicide.
Yes, sir.
Now, let us suppose I want. I want to hire a child, a minor, a 16-year-old gang member to do my dirty work for me. 948.40. There's no problem of charging under subsection 1, is there?
I wouldn't think so.
Suppose I want, could the prosecutor charge under 4B?
The death actually occurs?
Absolutely.
Yes, sir.
Prosecutor could charge under 4B?
Yes, sir.
And can the prosecutor charge on both of these offenses? I mean, you're basically saying that in this case, probably the prosecutor could charge under 948.41, but the prosecutor cannot charge under 948.44A. But I thought you just said that the prosecutor could charge under 948.44B in my hypothetical.
Because my position, Justice Prosser, would be that 948.44B is not a homicide statute. There's no requirement of death.
The person's dead. We recognize that. There's death there.
But there's no requirement of death to prove that a violation of that subsection. There's no requirement of death.
If they were charged, though, as parties to the crime of first-degree intentional homicide, and then the person who did the hiring was also charged as contributing to the delinquency of a child, your position would be that second charge would have to be dismissed because it's multiplicitous to the first charge. Right?
Are you talking about under sub
H? Under Prosser's example, if they're both charged as being parties to the crime of first-degree intentional homicide, and the person who does the hiring hired a juvenile, and the juvenile actually committed it, but they're both found guilty of first degree, your position is that person receives no additional conviction for hiring the juvenile to do it, contributing to the delinquency of a child causing death, because under 66 that would be multiplicitous. That has to be your position.
Justice Ziegler, the way I'm understanding it is Justice Prosser asked me whether or not the actor could be convicted under 4B, which is if the child's act which is encouraged or contributed to is a violation of law which is punishable as a felony. So that I would say that sub B is not a homicide statute because there's no requirement of death.
Okay, but if you had the same scenario that we have here, under your theory, the hiring person could not be convicted of the contributing to a delinquency of a child charge.
No.
I don't know.
Because he would be convicted of first-degree intentional homicide.
The the child who commits the murder is going to be convicted of a felony, and the felony he or she is going to be convicted of is a homicide statute.
Justice Prosser, it seems to me that that's the sort of thing that comes up, say, in like a bail jump charge, where the commission of a crime is included in those elements. And I don't think that sort of situation is multiplicitous, because the jury just has to agree that a crime was committed. It doesn't have to agree on what the crime was.
Well, I understand your interpretation of sub B, 948.44 sub B, is this is not a criminal homicide because there is no requirement of death. Therefore, the solicitor can be convicted and sentenced under 4B.
I think I'd have to agree, but of course, that would not be a criminal homicide.
That's right, but your answer is different under 4A because your view, which is the one that's involved in this case, because there it says a person who violates this section, which is Justice Prosser, is guilty of a Class D felony because death is a consequence. And you're saying because death is an element of that crime, it is a homicide. That's your argument in a nutshell, if I understand your argument.
Yes, Chief Justice.
Pardon me?
Yes. Thank you. I would urge the court to reverse the Court of Appeals. Thank you.
Thank you very much, both attorneys Karp and Sanders, for yet another argument in multiplicity and double jeopardy, and at least we don't have duplicitous in this case, and that's good, since I have trouble remembering the difference there. So that ends our hearing in 08-AP-1968-CR, State versus Patrick R. Patterson. The court is in recess until 1:30, when we will hear our third case. Students may stay, and Justice Rogensack will be out shortly. We are in recess.